Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. This is 21st Century Approach to Energy with Charlie Stevens. This is part two. You want to make sure you listen to part one. It was absolutely fascinating, and it's a precursor to the discussion we're going to have tonight. So, Charlie, welcome back, and again, thank you for doing this. This has been, for both Carolyn and me and the Soleri team, this has really been breakthrough help and intelligence with getting our minds around the intersection between energy policy and the, you know, the Mr. Global, as you call the rackets.
Hey, it's an honor for me to converse with you. So thank you very much for the opportunity. Yeah.
We found you through Financial Rebellion.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to start, let's just say in part one, we introduced sort of what the discussion was. We described your background and why it's so, you know, I think your background is so unique and so special for dealing with these issues. Part of it is because you've gone into many of the different industries and sort of uses of energy. So you've not only looked at energy, you've looked at the uses of energy. And you've also come to understand the impact of the governance system on all these different activities as well as energy policy. So it's rare that a person has so much knowledge in so many different areas and can really look at things on a sort of integrated basis. But as you said, you were a systems engineer and you're trained as a systems engineer. That's what you do. So anyway, but it's been quite wonderful to walk through the whole thing with you and go back and forth between these many different areas. So needless to say, your scope is very, very, very wide. So we're going to get into one of my favorite topics that has been so frustrating and why I'm so delighted we have connected, and that is the weaponization of environmental issues.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I have tried for years to sort through all the lies of climate change. And I cannot tell you I'll give you an example. Adam Trombley and I sat in his kitchen. He and his wife have this beautiful mansion in Scotland overlooking a lake. I mean, it's right out of Central Casting. And he was insisting that I promote climate change on the Soleri Report. And I said, I'm happy to do it after you answer these questions. And in fact, I published a commentary where I listed all the questions, you know, like, explain to me where global spraying fits in, explain to me where HARP fits in, explain to me, you know, how all these things fit in. And of course, he couldn't answer any of the questions. So I said, you know, I'm not going to cover it until I can have an integrated picture of all these different things that are going on as part of it. You know, I can't take half of reality and pretend it doesn't exist and then come up with a description of what's going on that only includes half of reality. I can't do that. And especially if you're a money person, you can't do that because no risk manager can pretend reality away. And right. It ended up in just me being screamed at, you know, at top volume by somebody I love, you know, a dear friend. Anyway, so you have all these discussions and you think, why can't I get to the bottom of this? So let's talk about the weaponization of environmental issues, and let's start with carbon and nitrogen. What's the true story here of carbon and nitrogen and what I call the climate change scam?
Oh, boy, this is a big topic, isn't it?
It is.
A little history. Again, when I was doing this modeling way back, we couldn't, the science was not well advanced enough that we could actually take, the science was pretty fixed. I mean, in 1886, Svante Arrhenius figured out that without the moisture and the CO2 in the atmosphere, and they're pretty small amounts. I mean, you're only talking, you know, parts per million here, you know. And right. So the Earth would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit, average global temperature, colder than it is. So, you know, this was 1886. I don't think that's been disputed ever since, that that much, that tiny little bit, and in those times, if you go back in the Greenland ice cap drilling records where they actually obtained air from several hundred thousand years ago, in other words, going back almost 800,000 years, they actually captured real air in air bubbles that are in the ice, right, and they analyzed what was in the air. All of these other measurements that look back thousands or hundreds of thousands of years are inferred data. They're inferring that the temperature must have right. been this because of other things. But they actually measured the CO2 in the air bubbles going back, and it does fluctuate. So mm-hmm. one of the truths that they throw in here is that, yes, CO2 has in the historical record fluctuated up and down. Right. It's run pretty much between about 180 and 320 parts per million. So it's gone up and down in that range. Well, you know, as most people know, we're up to 415 or so now. Right. So if you think that, say, on average, 225, 250 parts per million makes a 60 degree Fahrenheit difference, and the low levels have created, you know, little ice ages like we had during the Greenland mm-hmm. evacuation there right. a few centuries ago, then what difference do you think 500 or 600 parts per million is going to make? I mean, if 225 or 250 makes a 60 degree Fahrenheit difference on global average temperatures, do you think that 500 or 600 isn't going to matter? I mean, that's preposterous. So the other thing is that people show, well, look, temperature's gone up and down for millions of years. It's like, well, yeah, right. it has. Why? You know, no one ever explains why. They put this graph up there, and it's a sawtooth graph, up and down, up and down, up and down. And it's like, well, yeah, but why? What factors made it do that? And if you can answer that question, then my next question is, are those factors still in play? Are they still doing that? And is what we're doing on top of those effects and, right. and modifying those in some way? And the answer is probably yes. So the real truth is that yes, climate does change. It has changed over the eons. It's due to a combination of effects. But one thing is certain is that they've measured back hundreds of thousands of years to the CO2 levels, and we're way past where that range has been. Now, other
things. We're higher now than as far as we know we've ever been.
Yes. It's a hockey stick. I mean, it 415 is way above 250, which is kind of an average of the pattern of 180 to 320.
So if you're the rackets and we're wasting huge energy and it's contributing to this.
They knew.
Maybe we should stop wasting energy. I mean, they've been doing this intentionally. Whatever's driving carbon up, they've been doing it intentionally.
Well, they made a decision, some of this history we aren't going to talk about today about what the rackets right. have been doing since the 1950s, but except for weather engineering, we can talk about that. But the fact is that in the 1980s, the people who first realized that if we burned all of the oil and coal and all of the carbon dioxide producing, carbon is a bad word. It's carbon dioxide, really, it's not carbon. Right. It's carbon dioxide. That is the molecule that is responsible. So if we burned all that stuff, we probably would cause climate change. ExxonMobil knew that. The right. Peabody Coal Company knew that. The Western Fuels Association knew that. They were talking about it in the 1960s and 70s, and they knew. And they made a deliberate choice in the 1980s to invest hundreds of millions of dollars. I think they've invested, one report I saw between 2008 and 2018, these people invested $2 billion to debunk the notion that climate change is human caused. First, they tried, it's not real.
Uh-huh.
And that didn't wash. So then they said, well, it's real, but it's, look, it's been this way in history and it's not, humans aren't causing it. And it's like, well, but you know, if it's not real and it's not human caused, why would the fossil fuel rackets invest literally over these years, billions of dollars in trying to debunk all this stuff? Why would they bother? But they had to, because there was this group of scientists who suggested that, yeah, the science says that it's logical that it should happen.
Right. But at the same time, the rackets are running all of these industries in a way that will produce this. In other words, we have chosen to do this.
Well, over time, and making trillions of dollars doing that. And a lot of it's still on the ground, mind you. That's their stock price in the ground.
Right.
I mean, what would their stock price be if we just said you can't produce any of this stuff anymore? I mean,
but they have alternatives. Well, I believe they have alternatives, and they've chosen to go this way, and they've chosen to have a system which uses tremendous waste. It doesn't have to waste.
Well, and but they worked on how to engineer it. I mean, I was reading papers on some of the core of this on stratospheric physics. The Russians were really early in this in the 1960s, and those are the papers I was reading, the English translated versions of Russian papers on stratospheric physics and how, you know, what's going on in the stratosphere and the materials in the stratosphere, the compounds, the molecules would alter the flow. The climate change, the climate is maintained by a balance. There's massive amounts of energy inflowing every day.
Right.
And massive amounts of energy flowing out every day. Massive terawatt hours of energy, much more than we need. But the balance is what matters. If the balance gets off a tiny percentage, 0.0001%, those massive flows, 0.001% of that is a big number.
Right.
The balance has to be maintained. And if it isn't, if something up there prevents as much from escaping as came in every day, then it's going to build up.
Right.
It's inevitable. And the balance is very small. And the parts where we're messing with it are pretty small, but the flows are so large that a small fraction of a very large flow is a big difference.
Okay.
So the oceans have heated up and absorbed a lot of that energy. They're warmer than they used to be. They have also absorbed CO2. And they have become more acidic.
Right.
Because they become more acidic, there's a lot of sea life that can't make a shell anymore to live in.
Right.
And so we're killing off parts of the ocean food chain by making the ocean acid. So the CO2 is absorbed by it's not just global warming or climate change, it's what it's doing to the planet.
Okay, so when we made a decision to globalize or to do a whole new round of globalization, and we instituted the World Trade Organization, instituted the GATT, the Uruguay round of GATT, we made a decision to dramatically increase the environmental pressure on the planet by doing that. You know, and shipping all the manufacturing to China. So
I'll put it simply to start with, in my opinion, and again, this is my assessment of, you know, after 40 years of really looking at this stuff in some detail, climate change is real. Human-caused climate change is real. Yes, it's added on to whatever else is going on in the way of cycles, sun cycles, volcanoes, you know, that occasionally blow up, like the one in Tonga here recently. Those things definitely happen. They definitely have an impact, a very measurable impact, no doubt. What we're doing is just on top of all of those things.
Right.
So, but the thing is, everything the globalists, that the racketeers are telling us that they're doing in response to the problem of climate change
is
a lie.
Right.
It's a lie. Nothing they're doing is about addressing climate change, because everything we could do to address climate change should be done for other reasons that don't just have to do with climate change, like going to regenerative agriculture. There's lots of better reasons to do
well,
that.
Well, it's stopping waste and stopping environmental damage of lots of different...
Making our health better. I mean,
right.
Restoring ecosystems, thriving ecosystems. I mean, look at the regenerative farmers like Will Harris and Joel Salatin right. and those people. They're doing great work, and they have, you know, that's how agriculture should be done. That's how it was done before the industrial people came along and perverted the whole thing. But right. if we did that, massive amounts, probably something on the order of half of the excess CO2 in the atmosphere right now would end up in the soil, and we would have soil instead of dirt. I mean, we're a nation right. of dirt farmers right now.
Right.
There's no biology in the dirt.
Right.
And we're not growing healthy food. We're not, you know.
But we could.
We could. And right. the problem is the rackets would lose trillions of dollars in revenue if you added it all up. And they're not going to let that happen. So those solutions cannot be allowed to happen. Even though they would help climate change, they would help our health, they would help our energy situation, they would reduce the cost of everything.
Right.
All of those things have good impacts, but they all take massive amounts of revenue away from the rackets. And so they cannot allow that to happen. So they only have right. one solution for climate change, and that's to get rid of most of us.
Right.
Sooner the better. But they can't, obviously they can't tell us that. They can't tell you that they're going to solve climate change.
It's the ultimate marketing problem, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a marketing issue, you know? So they have to lie and say, oh, we're making 15-minute cities to solve climate change. That's hardly going to have any impact. Cows emit methane only if they're in combined animal feeding operation or confined animal feeding operations. Cows on grass hardly emit any methane at all. That kind of methane is symptomatic of a bad match between your food and your gut microbiome.
Right.
And they're being fed stuff that cows shouldn't be eating, like soy and corn and all that other crap that, by the way, is cutting down massive amounts of the plant life on this planet that used to use that CO2 to produce oxygen.
Right.
We're decimating all of the green area. We're desertifying large swaths of the planet. And I mean, when you add up all of the things that we're doing wrong to make money for the rackets that most of the rest of us don't need and would be way healthier for and way more wealthy from not having had to spend all of that stuff on healthcare, pharmaceuticals, expensive ultra-processed food that's poisonous. I mean, when you add it all up.
So I want to show you something about cost. So we're working on the learning plan for the Building Wealth, our Building Wealth effort. And one of the people who was giving us comments said, you know, you really need to give an example of a time budget. So Ricardo and I were talking about an example of a time budget. And I said, you know, one of the things we have to do is we have to do a little component where we take five factors. So remember, this is a time budget.
Okay.
The first factor is what I call the great poisoning. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's all the different things we've talked about in terms of what's happening in the food supply, the spraying, pharmaceuticals, et cetera. So that's the
right.
great poisoning. The second is shadow work. Okay, so that's
our own.
you buy a piece of equipment and you get a warranty and it's faulty, and suddenly you got the repairman coming three times over a period of a month, and you gotta stay home from work and wait for him, and he's late, and you know, it's on and on and on. That's an example. I have a whole piece I wrote on shadow work. Then the third is inflation. The fourth is interest rates. And then the fifth, and we're going to get into monetary policy in a second. And then the fifth is crime and safety. So I said to one of the team members, let's just look at your week, you and your spouse. So between you and your spouse for the last week, you had 14 days, right? 7 days for one adult, 7 days for the other adult. And we did a calculation looking at these five things. They had lost 4 days worth of time, or the equivalent in money and transferred into, that's how much time it took them to earn that amount of money. So if you just costed this out in terms of human time, out of 14 days, they had lost 4 days to these five factors.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I will tell you from talking with our members of our team and subscribers, you know, that's a low number because this is a couple that has done great and very intelligent things to protect their time from the rackets. You know, they're very savvy about racket protection. But that's the risk management component. How can you protect your time and resources and family from getting hiccuped and hit by the rackets? And if you look at the what's happening to most people, I mean, I just came back from 6 weeks in America. Every family I spent time with or talked with was, if you looked at their time budget, they were getting overrun by the rackets.
They're on the defensive constantly.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And that's families who are savvy. Families who are not savvy are getting completely, you know, all you need is one vaccine injury to just steal 100% of your time.
Yeah,
or you're dead.
Yeah, you're messed up forever.
Right. So
well, I guess I've lucked out. I mean, I decided in the 1980s, the late 1980s, that the pharmaceutical industry was, the people who ran it anyway, were evil.
Right.
And I resolved then not to take anything else they ever made.
Right.
So, and right. So I, you know, I'm never sick. I mean, I don't.
You look very healthy, Charlie.
Well, for my age, I think I'm doing pretty well, but I, there's a reason for that. My immune system is fully intact.
Right.
And I've been eating organic food since we had to start worrying about it, about the early 90s. And so I'm not poisoned in that way. I don't take pharmaceuticals, so I'm not poisoned in that way. I resigned my commission in the Navy in 1997 because of a vaccine mandate.
Right.
So, you know,
Do you have a well? Do you have your own well?
What I get is well water. It's not fluoridated. It's out of a good aquifer here. I live in the middle of nowhere, kind of in the desert, and we have an aquifer. The mountains that feed it are 20 miles from here, and it's really good water. So I don't have a well, but it's mildly treated.
So it's very hard for someone like me. So I believe there's tremendous environmental damage going on. Having traveled as much as I have traveled, I can see it. You know, from the spraying, I can tell you the environmental damage in a place like Tennessee is very significant. So not to mention things like nuclear testing, Chernobyl and other things going on. So I see tremendous environmental damage. I also know that it is possible to change the financial system so that, you know, the Dow Jones and living things can have a positive relationship. In other words, you could finance places with equity and everybody could make money healing and stopping all the environmental damage. So it doesn't, you know, this theory that we need to have environmental damage to make money is a bunch of hooey.
Well,
so,
it is.
Yeah, but
it is. But I mean, those things are different. I mean, one of the things that's wrong is that we have never done our accounting correctly. Domestic product is, I mean, they count cancer and illness and, you know, all those things that are highly negative. They count them all as positive. What if we did our accounting right? How would we be doing?
I could spend a whole Soleri report just on talking about the accounting scam.
Well, yeah.
Right. I mean,
And there it is. And then, you know, and as an example, what if we took all of the scientists in the chemical industry that we want to put out of business because they're poisoning us? What if we formed an entity and funded it from the rackets to put all of those same brilliant scientists to work at a good salary, figuring out how to undo all that damage?
Right.
I mean, why not? I mean, yes, you can do good things, but it won't serve the rackets who designed the system today.
Right. And so, that's why I think it's so important to keep coming back to the governance model. And but to get there, you have to integrate all this stuff. Now, let me just, before we leave climate change, how, when people are promoting climate or promoting the, quote, solutions to climate change, which, of course, won't work, how do you refute it? How do you?
It's, well, look, the science, like I say, is pretty clear. It takes very little CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, 0.002%. to give us 60 degrees Fahrenheit of temperature, global average temperature, to make this place habitable. It's foolish to think that doubling that won't have an impact.
Right.
And we have doubled it. There, I mean, that's a fact. The only thing I try to do anymore is try to get people to understand that, look, climate change is real. It's not that hard to address.
Right.
And the things we should do right away, it involves more not doing. That's what regenerative agriculture is. It's not poisoning us. It's not tilling. It's not fertilizer. It's not. All of those not things are what's causing the climate change.
And not destroying our children with technology.
And not only that, but all of the carbon, or half of the excess carbon that's in the atmosphere now, would in a very short period of time, if we made this shift quickly, be back in the soil where it came from.
Right.
And giving us soil, healthy soil, which is
right. And I should point out the, I just did, you know, we did Pharma Food with Elsa von Hamlin for the annual wrap up, which is an extraordinary look. You think energy waste is bad? Wait till you see Pharma Food. You have never seen energy waste like this, Charles. So that's up in the PDF on the website, and it's an amazing thing to read. But I just finished publishing an interview with her and her report on the Dutch farmers and fishermen, and you see the whole game within one sort of the Netherlands food system and how they're playing this game on the farmers, because they're coming back in after making the farmers switch to industrial agriculture. They're coming back in and saying, oh, you're bad farmers because you do industrial agriculture. You have 1 year to switch to regenerative farming, which, of course, is impossible.
It takes about three.
So it takes time and it takes investment. It takes investment of time. It takes some investment of money. It takes some, you know, learning. It takes changing your business model. Anyway, so I just want to say that there's one of the uses of the scamsters is shock doctrine regenerative farming. And that's part of what we're watching in the Netherlands. And, you know, the fundamental concept of switching to regenerative farming is a good one. The idea of doing it the way the Dutch are, you know, they're doing it to push the farmers off the land and destroy them.
No, that's a stupid way to go about it, but it's what serves the racketeers' interests. And so at this point... But I mean, that it would work really well. It happens really quickly, but it's not enough just to put the cows on grass. You also have to look at the processing and shipping and markets and all that other stuff.
It's the whole ecosystem.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's the whole ecosystem.
And you want it as small scale as possible. E.F. Schumacher was right. Small is beautiful.
Now, you know, when we did a wrap-up a couple years ago called The Global Harvest and looked at the whole global food system. And, of course, part of the Uruguay round and the Doha round was to try and get India and China to industrialize their agriculture and go from, I think at that time, China had 35% of the workforce farming and India had, I think, 48%. We in the United States had less than 1%. And they were hoping to do the same thing, you know, to get China and India to industrialize their agriculture, which would make this problem dramatically worse. Am I not correct?
Oh, dramatically worse. But see, this is all for commodity traders. I mean, this is just control of the food supply by commodity traders, essentially, is what it'll boil down to in the end. But this is what they've used to control countries.
Right.
They hook them on imported food while they're exporting commodities. That's crazy.
Right. And, you know, of course, I love the interview of Sir James Goldsmith explaining why this is total madness. Okay, so let's turn... Very profitable. So let's turn to the role of monetary and fiscal policies, because part of the challenge of changing this is this model is very much part of the central banking warfare model. And, you know, you pointed out that rackets include war, but of course, war is the big racket. And we're on a central banking warfare model where the central banks print money and the military makes sure that everybody takes the money. And the key to the economics is you want to make sure that the military and the interest on the debt doesn't cost you more than you know, the subsidy you're getting from playing this game. So talk a little bit about what war is doing to the model and to the environment, and sort of what is the role of monetary and fiscal policy? Because I've always said that a debt-based currency did more damage to the environment than any mining company ever dreamed of doing.
Well, it is. And you know, as Smedley Butler said back in the 30s, war is a racket. And it and the racketeers, the financial racketeers, I mean, this started, you know, in England when the people who ultimately founded the Bank of England in 1694, they were loaning money to the to the monarchies in England to fight their wars and making enormous amounts of money. And that's what they've been doing ever since.
Right.
Well, if you look at our the budgets that we hear about that are in the newspapers are highly misleading, because the only numbers they ever give you is DOD, the Department of Defense numbers.
Right.
Which are, you know, they're high. They're in the $700-800 billion range. The real violence racket budgets are double that.
Right.
You have to go find the rest of the money. A bunch, the whole nuclear programs in the Department of Energy, the space programs in NASA, the, you know, I mean, there's then there's the black ones that we don't even know what their budgets
are. So if you add the black and the missing money, you're talking about, you know, the overt budget, even including all those different agencies, is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And it's, and when you add it all up, it is more than, I mean, if I could wave my magic wand and do away with the entire federal government, except for the violence rackets, we would still be in the red.
Right.
It's 70%. It's 70% of the, you know, discretionary spending.
Right.
Well, what for? I mean, it uses, last I knew, the military used directly about 7% of our energy, and the armaments industry that supports all of that was using about 1/6 of the commercial and industrial energy combined.
Right.
It's a huge amount of energy they're using, and they're destroying the planet with it. They build stuff that's supposed to be blown up and replaced.
Right. And occasionally they just do something that causes a lot of it to be blown up so that they can order more.
Yeah. Like send it to Ukraine, where the old stuff will get blown up and we can order new stuff.
Right.
But that this is all, you know, it's all part of the rackets, but it's the enforcement arm of the rackets.
Right.
I mean, this is what you make the rest of the world toe the line with.
Right.
And you know, set themselves up to be looted. I mean, that's essentially what happens. They're setting the rest of the country up so that they can be looted like we are.
So whether it's the war machine or technology, you know, digital dollars or any digital money, all of these different things, what is the true cost, in your opinion, of the control grid?
Oh, my God. And money? Or, I mean, it's... well, let me put it this way. Without having to pay for all of that stuff directly or indirectly, we could all have a really wonderful standard of living, safety, security, and everything else, working 3 days a week.
Right. Right. There's no need for poverty on this planet.
No. And everybody who wants work, good work, could have it. The work that we would have would, in general, be way better work than what people are doing now.
Right.
We're having to, we don't own our work. Our work, our labor is owned by somebody else, and it's being set up for confiscation every time you sign a contract to turn over right. another piece of your income to the bankers or whoever. And it's just being confiscated everywhere. So like I said, the cost of this providing no security, bad health, and not very good work in a lot of cases, is huge, and the benefits are dwindling.
Right. What came out with my discussion with Elsa, she used a quote from John Rappaport in his wonderful interviews with Ellis Medavoy, where Ellis describes that the greatest way to protect yourself or for the rackets to protect themselves is with complexity.
Yes.
And so I want to turn to talk about real solutions. Part of real solutions is helping people see, I think it was Schumacher who said Schumacher who said, we need to see the world whole. And,
yes.
And we've reached a point where we truly have a win-lose relationship with the rackets because they've decided we have to go. And so,
yes.
So it's us or them. And
yeah.
And so, but we can't begin to make real progress on this unless we can see the world whole. And that means yep. seeing the financial system with the energy, with the media, all these different things, and seeing it whole. And the question is, how do we help people do that?
Well, there's two sides to that coin. One is truth and reality that would allow us to see it whole. In all of its aspects, and there are a lot of aspects. And the other is the propaganda and the lies and the deceit that's on the other side of the coin, because I survived a lot of this because in the early 1990s, I turned off the television, I turned off the commercial radio, I turned right. off all of the sources of the propaganda and set about looking for sources of reality and truth to read mostly. And occasionally right. watch or listen to. And so I'm not sure I could have come to where I am if I hadn't shut off the propaganda.
I threw out the TV in 1984 and started to read books. And then in 1989, I went to all nonfiction books because I just said I need to read a lot to get to the bottom of all of this.
Yeah, and it has to be serious, in-depth kind of reading. I just went from book after book after book and reading 20, 25 books every year, serious, you know, thick books about macroeconomics, foreign policy, you know, all this stuff, environment. Right. So people have to quit tuning in to the propaganda, in part because it works. I mean, you know, if you tune in, it will alter how right. you think and believe. But also because it takes time to be propagandized, to sit there and watch it, to listen to it, to read it. And
so
spending that time differently.
I think the greatest obstacle we face is not just the propaganda, but the technology that makes the propaganda so effective. So I believe
yeah.
there's entrainment, subliminal programming, mind control. We're all digesting some of it, but the more you digest, the worse it is. And yet,
yeah.
you know, the greatest mind control is to persuade people there is no mind control.
Right.
Right.
Well, they do a pretty good job of that. And distraction works too, you know. I mean, I can't tell you the number of, I mean, I've always been kind of an outlier because I don't know anything about sports because mm-hmm. I never watch it. I used to participate.
So I've been told consistently that sports is how they get the men. If they can't get them any other way, they get them with the sports. So that must be it. You don't watch sports, Charlie.
I don't. I have no room in my brain for that information.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know anything. I can't even name four teams in any sport. But everybody around me knows, you know, the statistics of every batter, every basketball player, every football team. I mean, you know, it's like how they spend an enormous amount of their life
right.
learning all of that stuff and watching it evolve day after day after day after day and all of the propaganda that comes with it as though it doesn't have any effect. And it does, because these people believe things that just flat aren't true. And, you know, Bill Gates' great-grandfather, Frederick Taylor Gates, was sent by John D. Rockefeller to take over the education system in this country starting in about 1904. And they did. They took over the education system in this country. And we don't even know our own history, the real history. We don't know what's real. So the things we believe, here's another thing. People have no seeming ability to separate the concept of my country and the people who run it. You can't criticize the people who run it without being unpatriotic to my country.
Well, I'm based in Tennessee. We don't have that problem.
But, you know, I listen to these people who believe utter nonsense about their country as though it were a democracy and not a republic. They cite the founding fathers, and the founding fathers were plutocrats. They were oligarchs. They were ready to form a monarchy.
So one of the challenges is the IQs are falling. All evidence suggests that they are falling. And so the dumbing down phenomena is very, very real. And that's
true.
Something, right.
But, you know, I've been willing to talk to people over the years, but people don't want to hear it. I mean, the problem is you have to start somewhere. And when you're starting, you're not going to know very much. And a lot of what you think or believe is not true. And you're going to bump into all kinds of things that challenge everything you think you know or believe. And I don't know how many people can continue on the course when that happens.
So it's very clever the way they've done the climate change discussion. Because if the solutions to climate change are scams, then someone like me is going to say, I don't want to hear about climate change. Which is not the right solution, because we do want to hear, you know, whether you call it climate change or environmental damage, we absolutely want to hear everything we can about what is happening to the climate or what's happening to the environment and what we can do to address it.
Well, so, you know, communism was invented as a threat. I mean, to kind of wipe out populism. Populism was a threat to the rackets at one point, and they just invented an enemy that everybody could believe in. And, you know, it never was very much of a threat in this country. The only time communism ever raised its head was when the racketeers had destroyed the economy in 1929 and people were looking for an alternative. Right. But, you know, we don't have a free market economy. Not one of Adam Smith's characteristics of a free market economy are true today. People believe it.
So first of all, we have to get transparency and a percentage of people sort of understanding, you know, real problem, real solution. So that's number one. We have to overhaul the governance model. That's the hard part, because the racketeers have stolen, you know, they have a lot of power and a lot of resources. My belief is they'll kill each other, but we'll put that aside for a second. We have to evolve back to regenerative agriculture, and that has to be done in a way that's productive, not in a way that is shock doctrine or unhealthy. But we need an intelligent energy policy. So if you could wave a magic wand and have the most intelligent energy policy, and we'll just pretend that for now, breakthrough energy is going to stay in the closet, what would you do? What would you do?
Well, I would quit looking at wind, and I would do more of what I'm doing. You know, I earn a tiny bit of money anymore just taking energy out of commercial buildings, existing commercial buildings, all of which are horrible. But there are places all over the economy. If we got pavement right, the amount of energy we put into pavement would diminish dramatically. Everywhere I look, we're squandering energy on something we shouldn't be doing. But so it's not, I don't know that we need energy
thousands,
policy.
Right. It's allowing optimization to occur in construction, in residential housing, in infrastructure across the board. It's just allowing all these innovations to happen.
And I think the other thing is it isn't even so much an energy policy. Like I say, when you take a systems approach, I'm not just looking at energy. I'm looking at health. I'm looking at poisoning of the ecosystems and, you know, all these things that we just shouldn't be doing. And if every time I point my finger at something we shouldn't be doing because It's poisoning us. It's making us sick. It's costing us a fortune that we shouldn't have to spend. We're paying taxes to wipe something out. Every time I point my finger at this, I'm thinking, wow, what's the energy impact? If I did away with that and stopped that, how much energy would we not use? And it's huge. And so that to me is the energy policy. It's stop doing these things that are consuming vast amounts of energy that we shouldn't be using that energy for reasons that have nothing to do with energy.
Right.
So to me, the hard work is really getting rid of these rackets that are ruining our lives and using vast amounts of resources, people's time, and precious energy of whatever kind to do it with. And we need to optimize everything.
Right. Now, what I've seen, so you talked about your life and how you've protected yourself from the rackets. Mm-hmm. But if you just look at that time budget I described, people who are knowledgeable about real solutions, in fact, they're getting their food from regenerative farms. You know, they've left the industrial model. It doesn't have to be the whole system. Each one of us can leave the industrial agriculture model and go over to the regenerative farming model. We can stop working and helping the rackets. We can go do something else. You know, we can look at our own energy use and try and make sure our energy use is less environmentally damaging. So if you look at what one person can do or one family can do in their own life, it's extraordinary how much we can do. And we can all use cash. We can stop supporting the big banks. We can, you know, it goes on and on and on. But if you look at doing everything you can to withdraw from dependency on the things that are doing harm and do it in a way where you protect your time and health and money from the rackets, if everybody did that, the impact would be unbelievably dramatic. Huge.
Well, not only that, but that would not be disaster capitalism at work. It wouldn't be the Netherlands farming solution. It would happen. It would evolve.
Right. It's very evolutionary.
Gain momentum over time, but it would start small. It would start local. It would start with individuals. It would not be. I mean, you have to. One of the systems questions you always ask when people come up with these solutions is, what would happen if everybody did that? And you try to think out, okay, what's the impact if all of a sudden everybody did this one thing? What disasters are we creating? What would change in the system if everybody just did this? And in most cases, you don't want to do utterly disruptive, cliff-like changes in the system.
Exactly.
You want to evolve it as quickly as you know how, but it's not a bad thing that some people will be late to getting around to this. Everybody can have an impact and gain momentum in their own lives and contribute momentum to the group of getting away from Amazon, for instance. You know, everybody who's doing business with Amazon or Google or any of these people, it's convenient or it's too much trouble to do. And it's like, well, then you're paying for your own enslavement. And
well, if I look at a budget of 14 days in a week and losing 4 to the rackets, that's not convenient.
That's a tax.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's a tax, and that's a tax you want to protect yourself from.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a waste. I mean, it's a piece of your life. I mean, you're giving away a significant fraction of your life here.
So one of the most effective programs, and I first heard John Rappaport say this, he said, hopelessness is an op and it's planet-wide. And what you hear again and again is, I'm only one person, what I do doesn't matter.
Oh, it does matter. It absolutely matters. And in fact, you know, that's how you see some of these changes. I mean, the rackets would not be doing some of the things they were doing if they were not genuinely threatened.
Right.
So every time you see them responding in a way, you know, to what's going on, it's like, oh, we are really having a difference here. They noticed and they're reacting. And then we have to just react back and keep going.
I have to tell you a story. In 1988, I had a dear friend who was the chief of staff to the guy who ran CBS. And he calls me one day. So I'm a managing director at Dylan Reed, and this guy's at the top of CBS. He calls me and he says, my girlfriend is sick, and we have this huge dinner at Carnegie Hall, and we have a big table up front, the chairman's table, with all the top people from CBS, and she's sick, and I need a date. Will you be my date? So I love this guy. And I said, sure. You know, so he said, okay, I'll get all dressed up and come up. So I'm sitting at the table now. This is 1988. I haven't owned a TV for 4 years. I threw it out in 1984, right?
Yeah.
So I'm at the CBS table, and I'm sitting there, and I turn to the guy next to me. He's a very attractive, sort of Midwestern-looking blonde guy. I turned to him, and I said, and for some reason, just then, the table went quiet so everybody could hear. It just happened.
Uh-oh.
And I said, tell me, Harry, what do you do? And the whole table froze, and Jay froze, so my friend, and he said, Austin, Harry is the host for our morning TV show. And I didn't think, you know, it's not like me, but I didn't think, and I said, oh, Harry, I'm so sorry. I haven't owned a TV for years. And suddenly, everyone, this is all the top executives of CBS except for the chairman, looked at me in a state of panic and fear. They were so frightened. And I thought, this system is very fragile.
Well, look what's happened to the mainstream media here in the last 3 years. It's right. Going into the toilet. You know, it's their own right. doing, but, you know, that's where right. they're headed.
Well, it's funny. If you count the views on some of Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, for his campaign, you know, right. he's built for years all these relationships with alternative media. And now if you look at all those different shows and podcasts, which he's going back and doing, they add up to a market share that is so many multiples greater than the corporate propaganda. It's unbelievable.
Well, that's progress for us. I mean, this is how right. you disempower the rackets by trying to disempower the one of the biggest weapons they have, which is right. propaganda through these channels that are ubiquitous.
Right.
I mean, I've never carried my cell phone. You know, it's my home phone, but it stays at home. I don't carry right. my cell phone unless I know I'm going to need it for something while I'm out and about. But I opted out. I mean, I boycotted Amazon when all they sold was books.
Right.
And I said, I know where this is going. I love my bookstore. You know, no way.
It took me a year or two to figure out. It took me a little while to figure out where Amazon was going. So
well, they went to places I didn't even think of, but you know, they it's gotten way bad. But I mean, the solutions are all small scale, they're local, they're
right.
individual. We have to organize ourselves on a small scale. We have to think a little bit about the 10th Amendment.
Right.
If you're doing business and you're not interstate commerce, they can't regulate you. We should be going into all of our institutions locally, like schools and everywhere else, and finding all the federal money and getting it out, get right. rid of it.
Tennessee, the Republicans in Tennessee are now considering stopping taking federal education money.
They should.
So there's serious consideration being given to it. That one of the most optimistic things I've seen, Charlie, in the last year is the fact that there are state legislators all over the United States finally facing how bad it is and the fact that they are going to have to do something. And if they don't, I mean, one, they have to be prepared if the country comes apart. But even yeah. if it doesn't, they have to be prepared to assert sovereignty at the state level. And
yes.
I'm now beginning to see them move in a whole new way. And that's very encouraging because you have tremendous talent and experience in that group. You know, they are
yeah.
very, if they decide to move and move together, they are formidable. So,
well, you know, I've been a community activist for a long time. And I found there was all kinds of talent in every community right. I've ever been in. And you just have to tap it.
Yeah. The good news is the rackets have thrown a lot of talent out.
Yes, they have. And
it's available.
It is. And look at, we see a lot of it, you and I, when we do look at CHD and the high wire and places like that. Right. I mean, there's a lot of talent right. out there.
Yeah.
Honest people of integrity. It's good.
Yeah. Okay. So this ends part two. This has been incredibly valuable. We're coming down to changing the governance model. And of course, that includes the debt-based central bank warfare model. Evolve Absolutely. From industrial agriculture to regenerative and an intelligent energy policy, which is not so much necessarily changing energy as changing the waste in all these different areas that are using much more energy than they need to be.
Yeah, and you can drop off all the worst stuff that you decide is the worst of our energy consumption as our consumption goes down because we're using it appropriately. Then right. you just drop away all the stuff that's the worst that, you know, we'll all collectively decide what is the worst. And then we'll that'll be the first to go as we reduce our demand.
Right, right.
And that's really the sensible energy policy is we're wasting so much. It's a no-brainer to start there.
Well, I personally would like to thank you for spending 30 plus 20, 50 years figuring this all out.
Well, it's working so far, and I'm happy to share at long last. Not that many people have been all that interested in hearing about it, but I'm pleased that at least a few people will.
At the commentary for part one and part two, if people post questions, will you jump on and answer them?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I just got to learn how to do that. I'm not practiced in that
well,
at all.
Well, we can help you do that. But
okay.
For those of you who've listened to part one and are now listening to part two, I would encourage you, because we have some very smart people who know a lot about energy and energy policy. I would love to see them jump on and get in a dialogue with you. I think it might be very, very much fun. And, and some of these topics are so controversial, I'm sure people will have questions. We have a group of people who really love Ben Davidson and Suspicious Observer. And he's convinced we're going into a sunspot cycle, which is going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to navigate. Yeah.
It could be. That's more radiological than thermal.
Right.
But yeah,
exactly.
It could be challenging for electronics.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah. Anyway. That's good. Well, listen, I will send you what I have for links and stuff that people can look at and
so
go to.
I appreciate your sending that. We'll post all of your recommended sources and links at the commentary. Okay. We'll post the questions. If you need help figuring out how to answer them, we'll certainly do that. My guess is we're going to get a whole lot more and discover that part two is just the next part of what's going to be an ongoing conversation.
Well, there's a lot of stuff here. And I have an enormous archive, all of which I've read. I've probably read about 300 serious books and 2 to 3 times that much in the way of essays and investigative journalist pieces and stuff that I've collected. So if people want to know about something in particular, I'm happy to share. So anyway, I'll send that to you and we'll take it from here and see what happens.
Okay. Well, Charlie Stevens, thank you very much for joining us on the Salera Report. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you as well. Have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, Catherine.